the world's silliest family jokes. Okay, let's try one. I can't open it. At the barber shop. Ah, the barber shop. They got barber, like. Where do sheep get their... Okay. Where do sheep get their hair cut? Barber shop, yeah. Okay. Get another one tomorrow. Okay. Is there a contradiction? Relax to the max. Use all your mental energy in mindfulness. Yes. But when you relax, you don't lose mental energy. You get more mental energy. It's like we're wasting energy. And when we relax, we find the energy's got nowhere to go to. It just stays here and builds and builds and builds. You have more energy. So use all your mental energy in mindfulness, yeah? But you've got to make it strong energy first of all. So the more you relax, just the more the energy builds. Your body, when your body relaxes, of course, then it feels comfortable. And as I keep saying, when your body is really relaxed, it's no business to be done. So there's a save a lot of energy when you relax your body. And then number two, when you relax your mind, you're just here. You don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to do anything. You relax, and then you're right in the present moment, and it gets really powerful. Dear Ajahn, what does abandon underlying tendencies mean? I take it as a change habits by letting go of things. Yeah, you let go of things, but underlying habits, these are things which you've had for lifetimes. And so it's really hard to actually spot them sometimes. Sometimes it's just you don't even notice them because it's like they're always there. But after a while, those underlying habits, because you get very, very still, they just vanish for a while. And then when you totally vanish them, then you get enlightened. Oh, now this one. I always get this question every year, and every retreat, and I can never answer it. That's really deep. Okay, it's okay to laugh. Dear Ajahn, how can one recognize the difference between wanting and not wanting in meditation? When you want, the meditation never settles down, never becomes peaceful. It kind of gets close to being peaceful, and then you just a little bit more, and then I can get into jhana, just a little bit more, and then I can get enlightened. You think, just a little bit more, and it spoils it all. When a flower blooms, does it want to bloom? Or is it just doing that because that's its nature, cause and effect? Remember, there's a process which goes on in spite of you. You know, I'm getting... No, sorry, no, I am old now. I have to be honest to what my other monks tell me. I used to say, I'm getting old. They said, no, you're not getting old. It's so sweet. I'm not getting old, thank you. I said, you are old. I've already got old quite a few years ago. So, I don't want to get old. Do you want to get old? But it's not going to make any difference, is it? Well, I want to get old or I don't want to get old. I'm old. And that's it. So that's the difference. When wanting something, sometimes it just tries to disturb the whole process. And wanting actually usually hinders any peace and happiness. As I say, when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. And it's so easy to want something more. Wherever you are, it's ever perfect. If you could use your psychic powers and get a check for $1 million to each one of you, would you like to have that? Is $1 million enough? Would you like $2 million? Three? Doesn't matter how much it is, you always want something more. That really quite surprised me. Why is it that people who become millionaires always want something more? You get, you know, people like, you know, whatever you say about him, Donald Trump. You know, he already had enough money. Why did he want to sort of become president for? It's crazy. There is a reason for that. But anyway, there's a simile, which, okay, should I say it now? Oh, why not? Are there many questions? Not that many, okay. This is when people asked, enlightenment, the end of wanting. Actually, what actually is it? So this is a simile. What enlightenment is? Something you can easily understand. And it was a simile of the five children playing the wishing game. I think many of you have heard that many times before. But the story goes like this. Five kids, they were just playing, so they had this imaginary game, the wishing game. And each child has an opportunity to invent a wish, and whoever gets a superior wish would win the wishing game. And so the first kid, he said, well, if I had a wish, I can't think of any other good kid's wish. My wish would be I get a new PlayStation so I can play more video games. Okay, fair enough. The second kid, and never be the first, it's always the second, you get some more opportunity to get a wiser wish. Just like that story of the, I don't think I said this yet, about the three religious leaders, the monk, the rabbi, and the priest, the Christian priest. And they thought that, you know, it's a good idea to try and spend time together so they get to know each other and, you know, find ways of creating more harmony in the world. And so, first of all, they decided, let's go have some dinner together. But then the monk can't eat in the evening. That didn't work. Have lunch, and then just sometimes the priest and the rabbi and the monk have different types of food. That didn't work. So then they decided to have some games together, and eventually they decided to play cards together. And it just was ordinary cards, and then decided to make it more interesting to start playing poker together. So these three religious leaders, the rabbi, the monk, and the priest, were playing poker. And of course, it's no fun unless you put a few dollars on this, a few dollars on that, so they ended up gambling. And when the word got around that these religious leaders were gambling, the police came in and arrested them all. It's illegal to gamble. And so they had to go to court. And when they went to court, the judge said, you know, you're three religious leaders, I'm surprised to see you in here, but anyhow, you're being charged with gambling. And so it's asked the priest, the Christian priest, you come up first. Now, and I swear on the Bible, they're going to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And then he said, I'll just be straight with you. Where are you gambling? And he couldn't believe this, how quickly he said this. He looked up to heaven and he said, please forgive me, Jesus. Put his head back down. No one actually saw him. He was that quick and so hardly practiced. And he said, no. He asked forgiveness first, okay, so he could do that. Okay, you can go. And then the rabbi came up next and asked the rabbi, were you gambling? And what the rabbi did, he did one of those things which, you know, I was taught to do when I was a kid at primary school. You put your hands behind your back and cross your fingers. And he did that, put his hand behind his back, crossed his fingers, and he said, no, I wasn't gambling. Okay, you can go. And then the judge was getting a bit sort of dubious about their behaviour and looking up in heaven very quickly and then crossing fingers behind his back. So the monk came up and said, put your hands in front of you, monk, venerable. And I know you don't sort of believe in Jesus or God, so you can't ask forgiveness from anybody. Now be straight, you're an honest monk. Keep your precepts. Were you gambling? And the priest answered, with whom? That's why it's always useful to be the last. But anyway, so kid number two. Kid number two said, If I had a wish, I'd wish for not just a new computer game, a computer game shop. If I own a shop, I can get the next computer game when the old one is not sort of famous anymore. And with a computer game shop, I can get any computer games whenever I want. I own the shop. Very good, that's superior. The third kid, if you had a wish, what would it be? And the third kid had been thinking a bit longer, and he said, well, if I had a wish... Actually, am I getting this right? Yeah. Okay. If I had a wish, I would wish for $10 billion US. That's a lot of money, apparently. I haven't got a clue what money means these days. $10 billion US. Because with $10 billion US, first of all, I will buy my own computer game shop. But the trouble is that I never have time to play computer games because my mummy keeps telling me I have to do my homework and actually pass all my exams. So I can't spend time enjoying my computer games. So once I've got my own computer game shop, the next thing I'll buy is my own school. If I own the school and I employ the teachers and the headmaster and everybody, if they criticise me, I'll sack them straight away. And of course, I'll find some way afterwards about at the end of the year when we do the exams, I'll make sure I always get top marks and my mum's happy. And when I graduate, you know, with first class, whatever, from my own school, then I'll buy my own university, which is much easier. There's many private universities. And if I own the university as well, I can award myself an honorary degree. And my mum will be happy because I get all these degrees and certificates. And so I won't have to do any homework and spend all my time just playing computer games. And when I think of something else I need, I'll just buy it. $10 billion US, you can't sort of spend that in one lifetime, unless you're a government. And that was obviously a much more superior wish. And there's two kids to go. And the second kid said, well, if I had a wish, I would wish for three wishes. That's a wish. For my first wish, I'll have the computer game shop. My second wish, I'll have the $10 billion US. And for my third wish, I'll have three more wishes. That way, I can go on forever. Beat that. So the fourth kid had an infinity of wishes. And the fifth kid easily beat all the other four. The fifth kid said, if I had a wish I was so content I never needed any wishes ever again. That's a brilliant simile. Of course, the fifth kid was the Buddha. Fourth kid was like the presidents of our world. Always want more wishes, supplied, fulfilled. That's why, like a Trump moves from being millionaire to being a president. You have lots and lots of money, like that third kid, $10 billion US, but you need sort of this power, first of all, to be able to get what you want. And then the last kid, he knew the difference between freedom of desire, to get whatever you want whenever you want it, and the difference between freedom of desire and freedom from desire. And that's the Buddha. Those are the good nuns and the good monks, the good lay practitioners. It's not freedom of desire, have a powerful mind to get whatever you want, but a freedom from desire. So content you never needed any desires ever again. So that's the difference between wanting and not wanting. Not wanting is called contentment. And you can't just stop wanting, I'll go get jhana and I'll stop wanting. That's just like I'll get my first $1 billion in the bank and then I'll just retire. How many people actually do that? They know they've got enough money, They can't spend it off the rest of their lives, but they still go to work. They still want to do more. Because they don't know the difference between the freedom of desire and the freedom from desire. Anyway, next question. Can you explain the difference between the brain and the mind? Do they operate at the same time, or one has to turn off for the other to arise? When we make decisions, is it the mind, the brain that does it? And can you describe how does loving kindness energy feel like? The first one is a good question. The difference between the brain and the mind. When you are first born, your brain has not really developed very much yet. But there's all these amazing sort of stories of, like, it was actually a couple of days ago, we had over in Bodhinyana Monastery, this family came, and they were just telling me that their daughter, they're always, when she was about 2 years of age, when she could start speaking, started to tell them that she had another mummy. And, you know, that really struck quite a surprise. You know, their mum, you got another mother? Yeah, my other mummy. My other mummy buried me in the ground. And that was obvious, you know, because these were Buddhists. It's a past life. She remembered just enough as a two-year-old to know had another mummy, a very nice mummy, but the other mummy sort of buried her in the ground. And when she was talking about this, her daughter was now about 8 or 9, said, I don't remember anything about that. This is what happens when you are very young. Your previous life is not that far away, just a few years ago. And as you get older, usually the average about 6 or 7 years of age, that's when you start to lose the memories of your past life. The brain of this life takes over, and the mind just goes into the background. But then every now and again, you can go to a hypnotherapist, and sometimes that hypnotherapist can take you back into a past life. Many of you know him, one of our previous presidents, Dennis, he would do that. Not everybody he could hypnotize and take back, but some of them he did. And I got some amazing stories of, people don't mind me telling you just what happened to them. One of the guys he hypnotized, he got back into when he first came to Australia in his previous life. He was Irish, born in a very poor part of Ireland. He hated the English, as many Irish people did then. But nevertheless, if he could volunteer to be a prison officer, a particular type of soldier in the prisons in Australia for about 3 or 4 or 5 years, then after doing that service, he'd be given a grant of land. And he thought that was like a way forward in his life. And so he arrived, he was sent to Fremantle. And he remembered everything in the past life session. And he remembered his name. He remembered the uniform he wore. It was like, I think it's a grey uniform. And he remembered, like, red coats. You know, the British military in their red coats on Fremantle at the time. And first of all, when he remembered the dates and everything, he always thought that the red coats, you know, were not, they'd changed the uniform by that time. But then he checked in the local library, and yeah, there were red coats at that time. And he remembered his uniform and the name they gave that type of soldier. And that was totally accurate. If you did about 5 years of service, then you get a grant of land to farm. You'd be free of doing any more service. He remembered the name of his wife and the pub in Fremantle where he met his wife. He could never actually find the pub, but he went into the library, the Pitti Library over here in Perth, to look at the marriage records. There wasn't that many people at that time, so it was quite quick to actually to find who was married about that time. and found his name in there and his wife's name. And he remembered the place down south where he was given a plot of land. And he got the deed of the land with his name on it, his name from a previous life, this is. Everything he remembered was true. And so I remember him telling me, he went down with Dennis, he drove Dennis down in the car to go and see that plot of land. And you can imagine what it's like trying to get the farmer to let you come in when you said, yeah, I lived here before, you know, in previous life. And the farmer thinks you're mad and crazy. But anyone who knows Dennis, you know, Dennis Shepherd, he's such a nice guy. He's just, you know, just a really kind and approachable fellow. And I think it was his personality managed to, the farmer let them in. And he was looking for this stone house which he built in his previous life. And the farmer said, oh yeah, it's over here. And then the guy who remembered his previous life said, no, it's not. This is not my stone house, it's up on the hill over there. And that's when the farmer got really upset. You know, because what had happened, that stone house, it was like a heritage, the first stone house in that area. And it wasn't allowed to be dismantled. And the farmer had dismantled it. And he was really impressed. I mean, there's only the foundations up where this man said his previous house was. And the farmer's obviously, how the heck can you know that? But please don't tell anybody, because no, it's illegal, we get fined. And he even knew where his grave site was. As far as I know, he hasn't gone to his grave site yet. But, you know, you can check in the book that it's there. And lastly, after working in the farm, then he actually lived quite a long life, and eventually he died in an old house in Albany where he basically retired to. And all this information, and it was all true. You could check it in the books. And it shocked him. One interesting thing there, that this man who remembered his past lives that way, he said before, you know, he wouldn't mind having a drink with his friends. But after all that experience, he thought, oh my goodness, I have to keep the five precepts now. He gave up drinking. And it was kind of fantastic that just the memory of a previous life gave him that much information that he never wanted to break the five precepts ever again. Anyway, where can you get that information from? Not in the brain, but in the mind, that stream of consciousness, which is the mind. That's where that's stored. That's where kids can say that, you know, you're not my first mummy. And all that information, you can check it out, and it's true, and it cannot be got from any other source. And it shows that stream of consciousness, the mind, when it comes into your body, it has many memories of the past. But they get sort of overlooked or dominated by the brain when it starts to function. And sometimes, you know, through even meditation, you can get these memories from your past. And anyone who wants to try that, you get a nice deep meditation, you know, nimittas I think probably be the minimum. And you can do something like ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? And then you get, if it's going to work, it works straight away. Straight away you get some memory from either an early life, early part of this life, or previous lives. But one warning, because I've been telling people to do that on these retreats for a long time now, and sometimes people like warned me, it works. You have to have a nice deep meditation first, and you know, because the memory comes out straight away. They got a memory from a previous life, the closest to this life, when they died. And they said that was really unpleasant. Because when you have these memories, it's not like a memory of what you had for breakfast this morning. It's a memory where you're actually reliving it. You're really back there. You can imagine that many deaths are painful. And so they said, you know, I did this and I got this really painful experience as my previous life's death. And that was really awful. Ajahn Brahm, please don't ask people to do that anymore. And I apologized. And so when I tell these stories now, I always say, if you do get an unpleasant previous life experience, immediately just say, earlier, please. Because, you know, your mind has got that power, earlier, please, and you can actually scroll back to, and that will be usually a much more enjoyable time. You can see some of the memories even through hypnosis, you know, where you got married, you got a job, you got your first house. Those are the ones which have power too. And those are only just stored in the brain. Not in the mind, sorry, not in the brain. And then, when you die, or rather before you die, there's another phenomena which is, you know, it was getting so common, it's now got a name called terminal lucidity. And that's when a person is dying. They may have had Alzheimer's for, you know, years and have this phenomena, you know, the family know, you know, they're about to die, so they're by the bedside and it's the last few an hour or minutes of their life. And then suddenly they just open their eyes. They said, Jean, nice to see you there. Victoria, where have you been? They remember you. They've got clarity. And just suddenly they haven't been able to remember you for years or months or something. And then, you know, they're about to die. Just minutes or half an hour. Because what's happening there, their brain has stopped working. The mind takes over. They have clarity. And actually one of those stories, I just say this because it's probably the most recent. This member giving a talk about this at Nolamara Center on a Friday night, and at question time, this guy put his hand out and said, I'm a doctor. And that happened to me about a few days ago. One of my patients was starting to enter the dying process, and had already given me instructions what to do. They were in coma, unconscious for, you know, a day or two, you know, but they didn't know exactly when they were going to die. He said, when I start that process, here's in my little book, that little exercise book next to my bedside, there's all the telephone numbers, contact numbers of my nearest relations. So would you mind just giving them a call so they can come and see me when I'm about to die? And this is what this doctor was doing. He was calling up relation after relation, and he got to the daughter, Julie. I remember this. And he said, got through to Julie. Julie, come to the hospital quickly. Your father is dying. And her father had been out of it for a couple of days. And then he opened his eyes, turned to the doctor and said, please tell Julie how much I love her. And that was his last words and he passed away. That's called the phenomenon of terminal lucidity. The brain is not working anymore. The mind takes over. Sorry I'm talking too much about that, but it's really good stuff. And that's actually the difference between the brain and the mind. The mind can actually take over the body at those periods and just operate the body for a little bit longer. And when you make decisions, is it the brain or the mind that does it? Neither. The decision is cause and effect. If you trace it back, it's a long time before. And the decisions you make, as I mentioned this morning, if I tell a joke, especially bad jokes, that comes from my father. I had some bad news. My father came back from work one day, got some very bad news. You know, one of my friends had a motorbike accident and it was very serious. They took him into hospital and they had to, you know, operate immediately and they had to amputate his leg. He lost the leg. And as soon as the operation was over, they realised, you know, these things actually happened. They took off the wrong leg. And so he went back to hospital again, took off the other leg. It was unviable. And as soon as he could, he sued that hospital. He lost his case. He'd never had a leg to stand on. That I remember that was a joke my father told me. I don't know, I was only about 11 or 12 years of age. It's not my fault. Do I make decisions? I know sometimes you make the decisions on how I say things and what talk I do. This is now from Ajahn Brahm, a personal thing. When I start giving talks, especially at Nolamara or in Singapore or anywhere else, they give me a title, but I don't follow the title of the talk. I look at the audience. I always like to keep my eyes open and scan you, see what you need. And that's actually just where you give me feedback. And that's where you can give these talks. And I don't know where the talk is going to go. I might start off on title. You may say, what was it over in Indonesia? Can you please talk about Cukup Bagus, which is good enough? Yeah, I start doing that, but then it goes all over the place because it's talking about what you want to hear, not about the title. So I don't decide when I'm going to speak. You do. You make those decisions. How do you develop joy and inspiration in our practice, not just in meditation, but also on the path to Nibbana? You've got a choice. On the path to Nibbana, you have to do many physical things as well. You all know that story of I had to learn how to build a monastery, not just to teach in it. Bodhinyana Monastery, I did much of the brickwork there. I love telling this story, these tiles over here of Jhana Grove, the wooden floor, bamboo floor. Now, I was kind of organizing it. We had a builder and a developer, and I asked the builder a long time before, about over the New Year period, when's it going to be finished, this Jhana Grove? They said, maybe about February. He said, are you sure? And the builder said, are you doubting my expertise? It'll be finished in February. They were really sort of angry at me for actually asking that question. So I knew it wouldn't be finished in February. Maybe March. And so we had to organise the opening ceremony. And I thought it would be wonderful to have it in, I think, April, just at the start of the Easter retreat, the retreat we do in, was it April, May? So we organised everything, a nice big ceremony, and getting all the people booked in for the retreat. And because it was a long weekend, it's the Easter weekend, you know, we could have a nice ceremony here and then clean up and start the retreat the following day, as long as everything was finished. The night before the retreat was going to begin, when we had all these dignitaries coming to celebrate the opening of Jhana Grove Retreat Centre, one of the biggest dignitaries we had there was Dr. Jeff Gallop. He was a premier of Western Australia, and he agreed actually to come and open the place for us. And you know, that was quite a coup to have him come here. And in the about 6 o'clock in the evening, there was a big area of this floor, you know, where this brown bamboo is, had not been tiled yet. It was just concrete. The builder didn't finish in time. And the builder couldn't get anybody to work on the evening before the Christmas holidays. They were all busy in the pub. And so, what can we do? Shall we cancel? And of course not. It's a lovely thing about being in a monastery. Any problems like that, we have the equivalent of the 7th Cavalry running to the rescue. In those old films I used to see. And those 7th Cavalry was, of course, the monks. So there's a group of those monks led by dear old Ajahn Santuti over in the Kelmscott Temple there. They were up all night, Ajahn Bamari was here as well, finishing off this floor. They did it all by themselves. Finished about 5 a.m. in the morning. And then when they finished, they had maybe a shower, maybe a rest for an hour, and then came for breakfast, and then we started our big ceremony. And it was amazing. I kind of thought, yeah, that's how it should be. Just, this is the monk's sacrifice, you know, an evening without sleep, so you can sit on a beautiful floor there. And if you look in that corner by the door over there, there is a mistake. Just the thing doesn't actually quite meet. But no one actually notices it. There's no way of fixing it. It's just making the square like this is very difficult. They did a pretty good job. But that's actually our life. There's always mistakes done. And I get inspiration from that. Are monks really supposed to do that? I get joy. This was done how many years ago now? About 14 years ago now? I get inspiration from that today. A great joy. Yeah, well done, Ajahn and Santuti and all the other monks who helped out. What a beautiful job you did. I get inspiration from that wall I laid, even though it was two bad bricks. So I work and I meditation, but I also get joy in all the other things which happen. Somehow or other, we just work to a different standard. We don't so worry about payment or anything. We just do it. Let people know how it happened. And then that's gorgeous. So that's the inspiration. All of you on that side are sitting on the floor laid by Buddhist monks at the last minute. Pretty cool. Dear Ajahn, I have no questions. Great. Well, what was no questions? Just sufficiently joyful and a heaping spoon of gratitude. Only a spoon, how about a ladle? Of gratitude for you and everyone and everything here. Great you included everybody, because all the nuns here inspiring you. There's all the people in the kitchen, everything. Sometimes if you just get inspired by one thing or one person, that's not enough. Everybody's been so kind and just being careful and caring for one another. I'm not quite sure what it's like in the kitchen or at lunchtime, but is that nice and smooth? Sometimes I say if there's only one piece of bread left, you know, and you're about to pick it up and you see someone, they really want that bread, please give it to them. You're looking after other people. It's much better than what you eat for yourself. The greatest, most delicious food is not what you put in your own mouth, but what you sacrifice to give to somebody else. That's the joy. Dear Ajahn, is there a role for mantras to help with concentration? Do they lead to jhanas? Please don't call it concentration. Call it stillness. Samadhi, that's the best translation, is stillness. Actually, the only accurate translation is stillness. Concentration. If samadhi, meditation, meant concentration, what would this place be? Concentration camp, yeah. You don't want to be spending 9 days in a concentration camp. And there's more to that than just a joke. It's just the concentration is what you do. And once you have you have to hold it there. You can't maintain it for long. You know, people can concentrate and hold it for a few hours, but never as long as stillness. Stillness is stable. And that's why it's more peaceful, more free. And that is what it means, stillness. Nothing moves. And because of that, that bad translation, that sometimes people get a bit lost. They say they can't concentrate. I can't concentrate either for long. I can be still for hours, but not concentrate for that long. And that's what, and mantras are good for the beginning. They can get you really deep. But then after a while, the more complicated the mantra is, the more difficult it is to become still. And when you're really, really, really still, you actually can't even think a mantra. Thinking disappears. And you're really still. They can lead you very, very deep and enjoy it. But in the end, even the mantra stops. Then you really get into some really blissful stuff. Is there any role of your ancestors in your spiritual progress? Look, my brother, when he retired, he managed to try and trace as many ancestors as he could in the male part of our family. You know, my father grew up in Liverpool, and he tried to trace as many ancestors as possible, just in a kind of hope there was somebody who was interesting there, or maybe just wealthy. Maybe we could find out that, you know, he was a legitimate heir to some big estate in Lancashire or something. But he said all he ever found were all his ancestors were died in poor people's graves. They were all a lot of scallywags. There's no one sort of successful in anybody he found. You know, my ancestors. So my ancestors were never any Buddhists, never any sort of religious people at all, just people who died young, born and buried in poor graves, poor people's graves. So I keep up that tradition because I'm very poor too. I've got no money at all. Monks don't have any money. We renounce it. So it can't be anything to do with my ancestors. So there can't be that much of a role. Sometimes ancestors, great-grandparents or whatever, they can inspire you. I was always inspired by, you know, my the only those parents I knew were my maternal grandparents. But they were really nice people, very good people. They taught me a lot of wonderful things. But especially my grandma, I loved her to bits. One of the reasons was I could go to her house at any time of the day or night. And when, as soon as I knocked on, oh, welcome, my lay name was Peter. Welcome, Peter. Do you want anything to eat? Do you want some chips? And that may be like 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And in those days, I said, oh yeah, I could do with some chips. And then she would actually peel the potato, wash it, peel it, chip it up, and fry it for me, just a plate full of chips. When my mum found out, she was really angry. I mean, you went to your grandma's house and you gave her chips, that spoils your dinner. And then she would call my grandma and complain, and my grandma would say, if my grandson wants chips, he gets chips, and that's it. I loved her for that. You know, she just spoiled me to bits. It didn't matter if it spoiled my dinner or my appetite or not. Anyway. What is the difference between the feeling the breath and knowing the breath? What is the difference there? And this is actually when you are being aware of your breathing. You know, when you start to be aware of your breathing, always mention you eventually come into this present moment. You're not really watching going in and going out. You're watching that part of the breath right now. And the simile which one of the commentaries gives, this is from the Visuddhimagga. You can imagine this is a piece of wood, and you're sawing the piece of wood in half. This is the saw, you're sawing it in half. When you first focus, you can see the whole saw, you know it's going in, it's going out, it's sawing this way, sawing that way. But after a while, you just focus in on that tiny piece of that wood where the saw blade is touching. And you only see one saw blade, no, saw tooth, sorry. one tooth of the saw at a time. You focus in. And you don't know whether that tooth of the saw is at the end of the saw, in the middle, or in the beginning. Because all those saw teeth look pretty much the same. All you see is just that tiny piece of wood where the saw blade is touching, and just one tooth. And that means the in-breath and the out-breath start to appear almost indistinguishable. You just see a tooth cutting the wood. You start to simplify your perception of the breathing. You don't really know it's the beginning of an in-breath, middle of the in-breath, end of the in-breath, or the middle of the out-breath, or whatever. It's just breath happening. It's simplifying so much. The more simplicity you have in there, the more energy your mindfulness gets, and you start getting the joy coming up in the breath. It's a natural phenomena. And at first it kind of, what on earth is going on? Your breath is never a source of joy and happiness. Maybe going to a rock concert would be a source of joy and happiness. Maybe having the most delicious meal in a great restaurant is a source of happiness. But watching a breath was happiness. For many people, that's really weird, but it was happening. One thing about the training of being a scientist, if it's there and it's happening, you have to admit it. Then you find out the causes. And part of like being a scientist is exploring things which you don't expect to happen, but which are happening. And that means after a while you see this happening. And as the joy comes up, you can notice that joy is coming from the mental experience of the breathing, not the physical. The breath is joyful. It's a mental piti sukha. It's a citta sankhara. Citta means the mind. It's created by the mind. A piece of feces. It's ridiculous to think that's beautiful. You can think, wow, 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 wow. But that's true. That's what happens when your mindfulness gets really strong. You're starting, what's dominating you is not what the piece of feces looks like, but how the mind knows it. Fascinating area of psychology, which only meditators can experience, so it hasn't been really investigated. But that's what happens. Feeling the breath and knowing the breath, it's a different experience. And knowing the breath is usually with a lot of joy and happiness. The piti sukha. Dear Ajahn, did you or any of the monks you know have recollection of the past? Yes, I remember the past, what I had for breakfast this morning. And the reason I say that, look, I mentioned this, I think, when I was over in Indonesia, because people always ask those questions. Now, Ajahn Brahm, you've been a monk for a long time. You know, have you had recollections of your previous life? Who were you in a past life? Or, you know, what stage of enlightenment are you on? Or I already answered that question about Ajahn Brahm. Can you get into jhanas? What stage of jhanas? And we're not allowed, according to the Vinaya, to answer those questions. And that is really frustrating for me. And so many of you should know that, you know, I know loopholes in the Vinaya, so I use those loopholes, you know, to just say what it's like and how it feels. So that's why I say that story is of what's your earliest memory. So when I started to do that, the first thing which came up was an early life memory when I was only just a baby in my pram. You know, this little thing on wheels which your mother pushes you along in. And because it's not past life, it's early life, I, no one actually can criticize me for telling you that. So it's not remembering my past life, it's early life, but it gives you the information, what it's like and how it happens. And it's like, you know, this happened in the early years of Bodhinyana Monastery, sitting in the hall one evening, getting some nice meditation. I don't know where that idea came from, at the time. What's my earliest memory? But it worked. And straight away, I was back in my baby's pram when I was sitting cross-legged on a cushion over in the main hall of Bodhinyana. And it was fascinating because, you know, you were there. You weren't sort of like frozen, so you couldn't do anything. I could explore my baby's pram. You know, look, see what was there. And I think many of you know that one of the things, my favourite toy at that time, you know, only 2 or 3 weeks or months old, I don't know exactly how old I was in that pram. But anyway, my favourite toy was this light blue porcelain. It wasn't plastic. Porcelain pig, which had some beans in it, and my mother would shake it or make it walk and make it noise. And it's sort of, it was a cute pig. And I still remember its name. It was always called a very original name, Porky. A little Porky, my pig. But the other thing which I noticed, which, you know, gave, I didn't really need legitimacy because if you get those past life memories or early life memories, it only happens when these five hindrances have dropped away. And one of those five hindrances is doubt. So when you have these experiences, it's strange. It was one of the first times when, you know, you didn't have any doubt. I mean, really, not just I'm sure that I'm correct, but just, you know, the doubt totally absent. And that was because the five hindrances have passed away. I knew that was me. And also that the dominant sense at that time was my sense of smell. I recognised even little Porky the pig by its smell, much more than its colour. My mum by her smell. You know, the pram by how it smelt. And that was really quite weird because I, you know, I was a physicist, not a biologist or whatever. And then when I said those stories, people who know about how your brain develops say that's so true. In the early weeks of your life, the dominant sense in your brain is the sense of smell. That's how you recognize things. And the weird thing is, I know that's true because you can experience it as a middle-aged man at that time. These are weird stuff, but it gives a sort of sense of authenticity if you want to have it. But we don't let people know. And the reason is because then you become a bit of a freak. Already it's the case that universities or other psychologists, if I tell them I got any of these deep meditations or something, they would love to get you into their lab and put all sorts of machines on you and find out what's actually happening. And you never see me. I'd be like a rat in a lab. And for the scientists, it's wonderful. They've got, you know, somebody they can do experiments on. But they don't really care too much, actually, about the person they're experimenting on. They'll try and look after you, but you know, you don't have any freedom. You can't go and teach where you want to. You're just an anomaly, a freak of nature. Anyway, but it's for science. Yeah, I know, but there's more to the world than just science. So have recollection of their past? Yeah, people do have recollections of their past. Okay. Oops. A good example of that is this one monk in Thailand. He's passed away now, so I don't mind saying this. Do I mind saying this? Because this monk, he was called Ajahn Lee Dhammadharo. He was quite a well-known monk, and he set up his monastery in south of Bangkok. It's called Wat Asokaram. A very strange name for a monastery in Thailand. But when you know the full story, that this is it. This was told by one of his disciples to one of his Western disciples, who told me all about this. Ajahn Lee Dharmadharo, a very, very good monk, a forest monk, he claimed to be a rebirth of Emperor Asoka. You think, oh, that's one famous person. And as soon as you say that, couldn't have been Emperor Asoka. But then there's all this other evidence. First of all, you know, the monks who he trained say that was the case. He told them stories about it. And even when Ajahn Lee Dharmadharo was giving a Dharma talk over in Ubon, that's where Ajahn Chah's area, that in the hall, like a hall like this, this thing dropped from the roof. And no reason for it to drop from the roof. And it was one of these little amulets. Not an amulet with a picture of a monk on it, an amulet with a carving of Emperor Asoka. And it was weird. And he called his monastery Asoka Rama. And all the people who he knew in a previous life, they were reborn too and became monks with him. And this was a really great monk. He wasn't crazy at all. And this one day, a good example of that, he was a monk who, you know, when he was on wandering, and you know, he got to a village, and he told the lay people, you always used to have to tell the local villagers that you've arrived, so they know they can prepare food for you the following morning. And so he arrived in this place towards the south of Thailand, and the villagers said, oh yes, great. Can you please give us a talk this evening? We'll go back and have dinner, and then when we come back, you know, can you give us a Dhamma talk? And so of course he can. And so it was in about 2 hours' time. So he sat down under a tree to meditate for 2 hours, and then he realized he wasn't mindful enough. He sat down really close by to a red ant nest. They're the big red ants. And then after closing his eyes and starting to meditate and starting to be aware of his breath, he started to feel all these red ants crawling right up his body and then biting him. And there were millions of them. And then he says in his recollection of this event, he didn't actually know that moment when he actually jumped up. He just was, you know, enduring this excruciating pain of being bitten by these red ants. And the next thing he knew, he was running away. And he thought, I'm a forest monk. I shouldn't run away. So he went back into this middle of this swarming pile of red ants and very carefully and gently sat down, crossed his legs and started meditating again. But he changed his meditation from breath meditation to loving-kindness meditation. And it's obviously he's a very, very skilled meditator. And the ants, he could feel them just climbing up his body and biting him, but he just gave such powerful loving-kindness to them that after a minute or two, they stopped biting him. But then he could feel them crawling down his body rather than crawling up until the last one just crawled off his body. Just through loving kindness. And they had a beautiful meditation, and around about 2 hours, you know, the lay people were coming to listen to a talk. And, you know, I don't know if they had flashlights, they had like torches, like, you know, lit torches. And so he was disturbed by them, because as they were getting closer, they were like dancing. And he thought, no, every different area of Thailand has different ways of welcoming monks. So he thought this was their tradition to, you know, to do a dance when the monks came. But as he opened his eyes and looked carefully, they weren't dancing to welcome him. There was this huge sort of a swathe of red ants all around him. Millions of them, but just for a meter around him, like a no man's land. There were no ants at all. They were protecting him. He said, it's really strange. But you know, when he was meditating, they got the energy, and they were just protecting this lovely monk who was just meditating on loving kindness. Weirdest thing. This was a person who claimed to be Emperor Asoka in his previous life. Built a monastery called Asoka Rama. Actually, it's got different sort of designs than any Thai temple. And that's what Emperor Asoka did. He built his monastery in Patna, Pataliputra, and called it Asoka Rama. Interesting stuff. Dear Ajahn, did devas help you at all during your enlightenment journey, to my journey? You want to hear a deva story? Personal. The answer is yes, they did help, but in a way which maybe you might not expect. So, after 5 years as a monk, you know, you're permitted to just leave the monastery, you got your basic training, and you can walk, you know, on this Dutanga. In Sri Lanka they call it Charika. Just walk, you know, wherever you wish to go, and just with your mosquito net and umbrella, you can camp out wherever you need. And it's such a wonderful life, because whichever village you go to, you'd always get something to eat. So you don't need anything. It's like totally free. All my possessions at that time, I could carry on my back. They were light. Imagine that freedom. You don't have to worry about tomorrow's meal. You go anywhere in Thailand, you go on arms round, and you always get something. You don't have to worry about where to sleep. You can sleep anywhere, in the paddy fields, in the forests. And it's a total sense of freedom. No duties, no responsibilities at all. I love that time. But then one place which I was walking was through these mountains in northeast of Thailand called Phupan. It was north of Konkan, or south of Sokonakon. And as I was walking there, it was a remote area. It hadn't been developed at all. But as I was walking there, it was the hot season. I had a water flask. I'd run out of water, and it was really hot. And I was really, you know, beginning to suffer from, I don't know, heat stroke or you know, the thirst. But then I came to a ridge of the mountains. There's not mountains, like hills, foothills. And I saw in the valley there was a few houses. And they're just starting to develop this place. And so there were a few houses there. I knew that one of them would have a general store. And in a general store, they'd usually sell, you know, important things like kerosene, you know, matches, they'd have a little bit of rice if someone ran out, oil and matches. And one thing they'd always sell there was Pepsi Cola in little bottles. And then I thought it'd be wonderful if I could have a Pepsi Cola. And we weren't allowed to ask. And I remember this story of one of these monks many years previously. He was spending the rains retreat over in Burma. This was the time of the Second World War. And when the Japanese took over Thailand, the British in Burma thought that all Thai monks were like spies for their enemies. So all the Thai monks staying in Burma were asked to leave. Now go back to Thailand, because it's dangerous for you. And this monk thought, yeah, I better leave. But instead of going the main roads, which were controlled by the Brits, the only real way was to go over the mountains, through the jungles, which was a long way and very dangerous. And he'd been walking through these jungles, you know, for many days and hadn't seen any village. He had no way of getting any food. And this was a very strenuous journey. And he got so tired, he thought he might not be able to make the journey. Actually, many monks did perish on those journeys through lack of food. And I've been up those steep hills. They really are steep. And they really take a lot of energy out of it. It's very hot and dry. So anyway, he was thinking he was not going to make the journey back into Thailand. And he remembered some of the stories in the suttas of heavenly beings helping people. And so he said to himself, I'm a good monk, and I'm a meditator, I keep my rules, I live simply, and I'm a forest monk, I'm a good monk. If there are devas, can they please help? Help keep me alive. And that's when, you know, there's no proof of this, because, you know, this is what he wrote about of this event himself. But he's one of these monks, he's got no reason to lie, and, you know, he's a very great teacher. And they say he's one of the enlightened ones in that time. And anyway, he went round a corner in the jungle path, and there was this man standing. He didn't know where he came from. Hadn't seen a village for days before, didn't see a village for a couple of days afterwards. There's a man standing there in the middle of the path. Just standing, not walking. And he was well dressed. You know, I've been in those jungles. The people don't dress well. They're just in rags, usually. This guy was dressed like he'd just arrived in a helicopter from Bangkok. There were no helicopters. And he had a tiffin can. Tiffin can was little, what do you call them? Like saucers, one after the other, which people would carry to monasteries sometimes to feed the monks. Had a tiffin can. And of course, the monk is not allowed to ask or talk to him. The monk, a very good monk, just walked right past. And then as he just went maybe, you know, a foot past this man from the middle of nowhere, this man just put his hand up and says, Nimon Krap. That's a Thai word for an invitation. Nimon Krap. It's an invitation. So he turned around, he opened up his bowl, and this man, this gentleman, put delicious food into his bowl. Hot food. It was warm, the temperature was hot. How on earth could this happen? There's no restaurants or way of cooking anywhere close by. And it was like Bangkok food, really nice white rice and curries and some sweets afterwards, enough to feed him. And the monk can give a blessing, but that's about as much as a monk is allowed to do. But this monk couldn't help himself. He just asked a simple question, where are you from? He hadn't seen any village or any human habitation for such a long time. It's the middle of the jungle. Where are you from? This man in the middle of the jungle never answered. He said, pointed. That's all he did. A heavenly being helping a monk. And that's a story I remembered when I was on this ridge, really thirsty. And this was my science background. I always thought, well, you know, if there are heavenly beings, this is a good opportunity to prove it. And that's science, an experiment. And so I made that resolution, honestly, said, if there are heavenly beings, can I have a bottle of Pepsi? I really need it, because, you know, to rehydrate myself. That's a usual way of, you know, just rehydrating on a journey over there. You know, water, maybe a bit sort of dodgy water may give you diarrhea. But the Pepsi was okay, and had a bit of sugar and caffeine or whatever. And so I walked down there, and I wasn't going to ask for anything. I walked down there with my eyes down, just like I'm walking meditation, just the body length in front of me, not looking to the left and not looking to the right and being quiet. And as I walked into the village, it was only a small village, 5 houses, and then I could notice the general store was, you know, to my right. I walked right past it. No one said anything. And I really thought, there are no heavenly beings. That's okay, fair enough, I tried my best. And then, the reason why I had to walk past was, I'll mention this in a moment, but then I heard this sound behind me, someone running after me and saying the words, Nibon Krap! And I turned around, I hadn't said a word, and they were carrying this bottle of Pepsi Cola with a straw in. And the reason they had to wait, it does take a time to take the lid off the Pepsi Cola. So they bought it from the shop and they were running after me. Nimonkwa, I got my bottle of Pepsi Cola. But you know, devas, heavenly beings, are much smarter than that. And then I took the bottle of Pepsi Cola, sat down. Actually, before I sat down, then I saw another person running after me. Nimonkwa! And they gave me a second bottle of Pepsi Cola. And then a third. Nimonkwa! And a fourth. Nimonkwa! Another person came running after me. A fifth, a sixth, a seventh, an eighth, and a ninth. Any of you who know Thai culture know the magic number in Thailand is 9. If that had happened in Singapore, I'd have got 8 bottles, because 8 is the magic number over there, the lucky number. If that happened over in Korea, 7 is the lucky number. I got 9 bottles of Pepsi Cola, all open, straw in them. I put them in front of me. Okay, I admit it, there are devas. Heavenly beings, they're looking after me. And I made the resolution for that, and that's what happened, honestly. And I just drank a little from each one, because that was enough. And you can't drink 9 bottles of Pepsi Cola. A little from each one, and then gave the rest to some kids. They were very happy. There's only ever time I've got more than 1 bottle of Pepsi Cola offered, 9, because I made a resolution. So yeah, there are heavenly beings. They will help you, but only, you know, in the right time and place. Oh, there's only a few questions here. You know that one of the other heavenly being things which happened here? Now, who was here for our 30th anniversary? Oh, yeah. We had our 30th anniversary of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. You were here then, weren't you, Nolia? You what? You're not here. Oh, it was the 30th anniversary of our Buddhist Society of Western Australia. Ajahn Jacaro had left, as I was in charge. And when they said, you know, let's do an event, you know, because my character, you know, Leo Rabbit, rawr! So I said, let's give it a really big shot. Don't worry about the money. Just Buddhism has arrived in Australia. So I said, let's do a big, big celebration. Because it was on a Sunday. Waisak was on a Sunday. That was our anniversary. And we checked, you know, in city of Perth. They have this events place called Supreme Court Gardens. So we called up the city of Perth. Is it available to hire that day? For some weird reason, no one had hired it. So we hired it. We decided there's a huge ceremony there. We got a new big Buddha statue from Thailand. And it was going to arrive a couple of days before, so that's fine. We can bring it to the Supreme Court Gardens and have a big sort of celebration around it with speeches. And you know that I was got very friendly with the with the Premier of Western Australia, which was Jeff Gallop. So he said, yes, I'll come for that. He wasn't just going to send some junior person representing the Premier. He came himself. He said he would come. And we've spent a lot of money organising everything. We've got sort of letters of congratulation from all types of people, including the Prime Minister of, or the President of Sri Lanka wrote something for us. The Prime Minister of Thailand did, that was Thaksin at the time. And lots of other people, dignitaries, wrote these letters, congratulations, 30th anniversary. So he put a lot of effort into this. And this was in May, full moon day of May. And when we got up in the morning, it was going to be a really big day of work. I didn't mind that, but when I opened the door of my hut, it was raining. We checked the weather forecast. It wasn't just rain. A severe weather event was coming. and it was aimed for the centre of Perth. To hit the centre of Perth at 7 p.m, the time when our ceremony was supposed to start. And it wasn't just ordinary rain, a severe weather event. And so nevertheless, actually I should confess that, yeah, before I even had some breakfast, I was chanting so hard in my heart, come on, David, this is an important event for us, please help. And though when we got into town, it was pouring down with rain. Nevertheless, we put all the tents up and everything else up. And the Thai people at the time, just amazing. They just got soaking, just setting up, setting up the Buddha statue. And just, you know, we just got some quick food to eat just in the middle, and we were working all afternoon. And we had my disciples, monk disciples. One of them, you know, pulled me by the shoulder and said, Ajahn Brahm, we have to cancel. You know, we respect you. You ordained me. I've got a lot of faith in you. But we've got to cancel. You know, we're being embarrassed by you. It's okay to cancel. And I said, no. And another of the disciples, that was, you know, good old Brian Creek, he said, look, I was a sailor all my life. And no, you can't do this. I looked at the forecast, looked at the barometer. There's a storm coming. You know, you have to cancel. And I said, no. Three times the premier's office, no, not the premier, but his offsider, called and said, are you cancelling? And I said, no. They called again, no. Called again, are you cancelling? No. And people really thought I should be cancelled, embarrassing everybody. But anyway, just maybe half an hour before the event was supposed to start, you know, Cherry Jackson, her mother, which she was still alive, Shirley, I was in the VIP tent, you know, just helping fix things up. She came running in, crying all over her face. Ajahn Brahm, you have to come. And I thought, what else could go wrong? I thought, because of the water there, that somebody must have electrocuted themselves. And I was prepared for disaster. And when he came out, she never said anything, she just pointed up. The rain had stopped. The sky had cleared. And you could see the beautiful disc of the full moon in the sky. I wonder if she was crying. It was kind of, yeah, it was miraculous. No, it should have been still raining, but the sky had cleared in that beautiful full moon there. So we held a ceremony in the dry. The premier came. I escorted him from his car, you know, to his seat. We had all his dignitaries there. They were kind of impressed. We went through the whole ceremony, and after the ceremony was finished, then it poured down. After the ceremony was finished, that field flooded. The freeway was closed because that flooded too. It was a severe weather event, but it stopped for us. I remember this TV camera was there, and the person was supposed to be interviewing me or interviewing somebody, and all she was saying was, this is weird, this is weird. You know, not many people came. And the reason was, because to the east, to the north, even in Nollamara, the west, the south, it was pouring down with rain. And many people couldn't believe we actually held the event. And even the person who hired, it's like Reese, like party hire, who now hired out all the big marquees and the stage and the electric PA equipment. We had to get it to a high quality because this was in the centre of Perth. They wrote this letter back to the organiser afterwards. I said, I don't know who this Ajahn Brahm is, but can you please ask him who's going to win the horse racing today? How did that happen? You just asked the heavenly beings. This was important for us, our 30th anniversary. Victoria, were you there? No, you weren't, okay. But there's a lot of people who were there, and they can confirm everything. We did have a little shower, maybe for about a minute, in the middle of the ceremony, but that was very light. And then ordinarily all the ceremony was perfect. How did that happen? Anyway, I'll leave that with you. There are many more questions here. I'm sorry I was telling Dave stories instead of doing these questions. But I was a theoretical physicist before. I was as sceptical as anybody. If you want to actually have that confirmed, you can ask Ajahn Bamali. He doesn't believe many of these stories. But that one, he was there. It was true. Okay. Again, please, sorry for not answering all the questions, but you never answer all the questions. It just inspire you instead. Sadhu! 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 I'll just do a very quick other Deva story. And that was when that we decided that it's not really unfair just to have a monk's monastery. We should have a nun's monastery as well. So we're taking around all these places looking for suitable land. 20 acres here, 30 acres there. Oh my goodness. And that's not inspiring. And as we were looking for this place, 30 acres, Dover in Gitti Ganap, down Reen Road, we passed this sign, 583 acres of solitude. And I told the people driving me, let's go and have a look. I said, no, we can't afford that. How do you know? You don't have to pay to look at it. So I went and said, it's a perfect place. And we had been to the Dhammasara monastery. So I knew it was going to go on auction. We asked, how much is it going to cost? No one really knows. But apparently they were offered $1 million for it. We can't afford anything like that. So what I did with Venerable Chittapala's brother, Ajahn Chittamala, we went there early. We went right to the centre of, that big hill, just close to where Ajahn Wayama had a caravan. They didn't have a caravan there, we hadn't bought it yet. And we did some strong chanting. We did that. And then when the auction started, we could only afford 625,000. That's with borrowing from here all over the place. That was the limit. And Eddie Fernando, his wife Manel, she runs the library in Nonamara. Eddie Fernando was going to be our bidder on the auction. So he had the instructions, 625, that's the max. And we started the auction. And then 500, 525. Anyone bid 550, 550, 550, 575. Anyone have 600, 625? And Eddie put his hand up, 625. And I said, keep quiet, everybody. Actually, no. Sorry, I got that wrong. His limit was 600,000. That's all we could afford. So Eddie bid 600,000. And then this guy put his hand up. 625. Oh, I thought, oh my goodness. We've lost it. And then Eddie, 650. And I was standing next to our treasurer. And the treasurer was going ballistic. Ajahn Brahm, I'm telling you, we can't afford that. No way we can afford that. 600 was a big stress. Eddie would not put his hand down. And it was sold for 650 to us. That was actually the reserve value, they told us. We got it for 650, the reserve value. And do you think we had a hard time paying for it? As soon as we told everybody, they were so inspired. A bit here, a bit there, and we soon had enough money to pay the bill for it. You know, we were just pretty broke afterwards. But we had it. I still remember going into, I don't know if any of you were there at the time, going to Nolomar. I think it must have been on a Saturday. I don't know, it was auction on a Saturday. But anyway, going into Nolomar and telling them, we have an announcement. We have a monastery for the nuns now, Dhammasara. And people just stood up and clapped. We got an ovation for that. And it was well deserved. And so, good old Eddie Fernando. He broke all the rules. But it worked. I love stories like that. It inspires me. Okay, I better stop now, otherwise we'll be going till 10 o'clock. It's 8:48 now, so thank you all for listening. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And have a beautiful night. We'll do the questions.